For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, getting ready for the climax of world history. That's what we're considering as we press into this discussion by Jesus in Matthew 24 called the Olivet Discourse. We saw that already that he's kind of teaching that history is heading toward this massive climax that he refers to as the Great Tribulation. And he gives us a series of signs, which he calls the signs of the times. And he says, if you can tell when the season's getting ready to change, you should be able to discern the signs of the times. So these signs are listed here, and that's what we've looked at a few already. We're going to try to close out a list of them tonight. I want to also think about another passage written later by one of the guys sitting here during this talk, Peter, in his book in 2 Peter. He says, first of all, you should understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following after their own evil desires. They're going to say, where is this coming he promised? Ever since the fathers died, everything goes on the same as it has since the beginning of creation. Nothing has really changed. There's this so-called coming of Christ. Where is the hope of his coming? Yeah. Well, we ought to see about that. I think we'll find that things are changing. It's not going on like it has since the beginning of creation at all. Let's think about the notion of birth pangs, which Jesus brings up in this passage. Oh, nice. How'd you do that? Get us back in frame here. Let's reread the first few verses, and he comes down with the notion of birth pangs. As he's sitting on the Mount of Olives, his disciples come privately. They come to Jesus. They said, tell us when this is going to happen, and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? Okay? Jesus says, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I'm the Christ. They're going to deceive many. And he says, you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There's going to be famines, earthquakes in various places. But all of these are the beginning of birth pains. Okay. Now, I don't know, a lot of you are a little too young to have had that much experience with childbirth. When a woman is pregnant and approaches the time of delivery, she starts having birth pangs. And there is such a thing as false labor, where weeks before the child comes, the woman will have contractions that hurt, that painful. And then when true labor begins, the way you can tell it's true labor is that the birth pangs begin to intensify, and they begin to become closer together. So instead of every 10 minutes, it's every 5 minutes, and eventually every 2 minutes and so forth. That's as you progress, you have more intensity and more frequency. That tells you the birth is coming. That's when they tell you to get down to the hospital right away. Okay? Most interpreters who read this passage believe that it seems like this is what he's saying, is that these commonplace events like wars, famines, earthquakes, things of that sort are going to be like that. It's not that they happen. That's not significant. They've always happened. What's going to be significant is if they start happening at a greater intensity and frequency. And that signals that the birth is approaching. And so the birth pang idea. He also adds to this that you'll be handed over and persecuted and put to death. You'll be hated by all nations because of me. Persecution. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate one another. This is turning away from the faith is what Paul calls the great apostasy. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. So there was all this warning, a lot of warning about false teaching and kind of religious BS that's going to sweep people away. He says, because of the increase of lawlessness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be rescued. That one's a scary one in verse 12. Lawlessness, anomos. Nomos is law. Anomos, it's maybe an ideology of no law, the way there is no moral norms. The whole concept of moral right and wrong is considered discursive, you know, a cultural creation, something that's basically obsolete. And he says, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So in these verses, then, you have him scanning a number of these signs, which apparently should intensify and become more frequent as we approach the end. I've kind of, then he says, and it's right at that point that he brings up what we studied last time about how this abomination of desolation comes. That's the spoken of by Daniel. That's the beast, the Antichrist. And then he says, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, because that is when there's going to be a great tribulation such as has never happened from the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will happen again. And so that sequence of things, including the preaching of the gospel to every nation in the world, is directly associated with this last days, the great tribulation. Okay, so I think it's interesting to kind of break these down. There's at least probably 25 or 30 distinct signs of the times mentioned, not only in this passage, but in some of the other passages, of the prophetic passages of the Bible. And you can kind of break them down into maybe five different areas. One is that there is a sociological situation, certain sociological features that are going to be present as we come toward the end times. One of the pangs mentioned that is war. One of humans' favorite activities throughout our history. You know, there's never been any time on earth where there weren't scores of wars going on. And that's true today, just like it always has been. On the other hand, when you think of the history of war, modern war has taken war into a new level. When you think of the First World War, now we have such a thing as world wars. That's a new feature as of the 20th century. You couldn't have world wars before because it took months to get, you know, from one continent to another to different parts of the world. But under modernity, travel and transport has become very rapid. And so the world has become more integrated, and war now can span across the entire world. They called the World War I the war to end all wars. And we've hardly had any trouble since then. 8 million dead. Battlefield dead in World War I. World War II, 50 million. 50 million. Wholesale slaughter at a level that the world has never seen. But the bad part is these are kind of like warm-ups. You know, if we have another world war today, it would probably dwarf these. And especially with the advent of nuclear weapons, war is moving into a realm that is unimagined before in history, and which is just too scary to contemplate. So this particular sign seems to me like it's at hand, and that we can see that intensification of war. This other one that he mentioned, lawlessness, in verse 12, because of the increase in lawlessness, most people's love will grow cold. It's hard to say, you know, some of these are kind of hard to interpret. People have always been lawless. People have always broken the moral law. They've never followed the law in any place or time. But I wonder if this isn't even going beyond that, that it's not just that people don't follow and do what they know is right, but that they have denied the existence of such a thing as right. That seems like a new development in our own day, kind of the postmodern denial of any and every moral norm. When that happens, as it has certainly in the West, it makes close relationships dangerous. You know, people are out hunting. They're prepared to take advantage. To have closeness in relationship, you need to be under, you know, you and the people you relate to need to be under moral restraint that makes it safe to open up to other people, to be vulnerable to other people, to where they're not going to rip your guts out the first chance they get, you know. And so in a lawless and an anarchical situation, anarchy is another translation for this word, people just basically have to back away and keep everyone at arm's length. You have to protect yourself by keeping relationships to a certain level of shallowness. You know, having a Facebook relationship, friending someone on Facebook, that's okay. We do that because it's just, you know, it's little BS quips that we're making to each other. But to really get close to one another, to experience real love, becomes increasingly unlikely in this kind of situation. I don't know what it would take to say that this sign is at hand. I think it is at hand, in fact, and that this is a kind of a new development under modernity and postmodernity that we have not seen in history before. Is it true that people's love is growing cold in our day? You know, in the West, it's interesting that not only is marriage failing, we discussed and studied that a while back, but increasingly that people are unwilling to even try marriage, you know, because they're so cynical about the chances of a marriage succeeding that it's just, you know, easier to live with people or just sleep around. And I think this is a very menacing development. You have increasingly now the majority of urban children are not raised in a family. And sociological, psychological research shows that that is a huge risk factor for children to be in a single parent family, to miss that opportunity to grow up in a secure environment such as a traditional family. And the traditional family is history at this point. It's now the minority of groupings today can be considered a traditional family. We crossed that line about 10 years ago. And now you have serial marriages, or you just have people, a huge percentage of people who never even get married. They just have children together and also change partners from time to time. I think it's a perilous place, relationally speaking. And I think that we're going to see people's love growing cold. You have to protect yourself in this situation. I think this sign may be at hand today. And I speak as an older person. I believe that it's changed right in front of my eyes during my lifetime. Moving from the 50s and 60s up to the 21st century, it's real noticeable. There's also a peace and safety movement that's described in 1 Thessalonians. People, everyone on the earth is crying peace and safety. And it's not clear whether this cry is a plea, you know, where people are like hoping for peace and safety, or maybe a confident statement, you know, that finally we've achieved peace and safety. And it seems like that's what it is. It's the second one. And it has to do with this unification of the world that comes about very suddenly near the end of history, and it makes everyone think finally we have peace and safety. It doesn't work out that way. There's certain theological signs mentioned here. One very clear, right there in 14, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached into every nation as a witness, and then the end shall come. It's an interesting prediction. Who would have believed? You know, when Jesus said that, there's just a handful of a dozen guys sitting on the hillside. And he says, this, what I'm teaching to you is going to go into every nation on earth. That has happened. And the earth since then. Christianity has become by far, you know, the leading religion. And tragically, a lot of it's also pseudo and so-called Christianity. But without a doubt, if, you know, the spread of Christianity has been staggering It is truly a worldwide faith. In fact, people used to consider Christianity kind of a Western European thing. Not anymore. The overwhelming majority of Christians today are in the developing world, and that is where the growth is happening as well. People of color predominate way over people from, you know, white Europe. So, and it's hard to say when this sign would actually be fulfilled. The expression to all the nations in Greek is panta ta ethnoi, all the peoples. Which you get ethnic from that. And so it's hard to say, does that mean nation states, or is this ethnic linguistic groups within nations? So that within some nations, like in India, where there would be scores of peoples, hundreds of peoples that have distinct language and cultural settings, and this is true in other countries as well. Most missiologists assume that it's not just nation states, because if this just means nations, like in our sense of the word, then this sign's already fulfilled today. It's already happened. Every nation on earth has a witness and growing Christian church in it already. There are still, however, groups, linguistic subgroupings that still have no group of Christians among them. All of the big ones are gone. In fact, when I started studying this, when I was in school, there were 25,000 unreached people groups. That was in the early 70s, and a big push was on to reach all of them before the year 2000. Didn't happen, but they have cut it down to 7,000 out of 25,000. And all of the big ones have been penetrated and have reached now. Only a number of small, inaccessible people groups still left. This sign may be fulfilled. For all we know, this may have already been fulfilled. It's certainly very close to being fulfilled. The great apostasy, as Paul calls it in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, is where the so-called church falls away. Apostasy means to fall away. And it's the same thing Jesus referred to. Many will deny the faith. That these are believers, these are supposedly believers, followers of God, who are carried away off by all the false prophets and false teachers that come and wind up denying their own faith. So false teaching has been very prominent throughout church history, as I've argued here before, and it's really prominent today as well. You have vast swathes of so-called Christianity who don't even believe that knowing Christ is a matter of faith or is on the basis of the grace of God. They think that you have to work your way to heaven. You have denominations made up of millions where the leadership of those denominations don't believe the Bible and don't even believe in God. And yet they continue to operate churches. We're like, well, why would you pick a career as a clergyman if you didn't believe in God? Because it's not a bad living. And I mean, a lot of them got into it. A lot of them started out as believers. But seminaries today, mainstream seminaries, can strip a person's faith away. So we have all the mainline denominations today, the overwhelming majority, like 90% of their preachers and priests, when asked the question, do you believe that the Bible is the inerrant word of God? Answer, no. 90% of your leadership in mainstream denominations today. So I'd say that's pretty bad. And we could study this for a while, but I don't think we have time. I'm just going to say, I don't know what it would take to have this sign be fulfilled, but it certainly could be, for all we know, that this sign's already fulfilled. Ecological signs are mentioned in this list of Jesus's and in other passages as well. One we mentioned last week was overpopulation, and we saw this growth chart of human population where since 1830, when we reached our first billion people on earth, that it has soared up to where we are today at 7 billion and is headed straight on up from there to probably 8, 9 billion or 10 billion people on Earth within the next couple or three decades. And so this is part of what's driving a lot of the ecological signs that were given in the Bible. Oh, think of that verse, Peter's. Where is this sign of his coming? Ever since the fathers fell asleep, everything stayed the same as it ever was since the creation. Not this. Like, this has been the same all the way back to creation. Looks a little different to me. That sign's definitely there. Jesus mentioned famines, like the birth pangs of a woman in labor. Tragically, we can anticipate this. We're already witnessing it. How many people do you think died of malnutrition and hunger last year? Anybody have that number on the tip of their tongue? How about 50 million? That's what the World Food Congress says per year. That number dwarfs anything that you would have had, you know, in previous centuries. This is entirely a modern phenomenon to have that many people starved. And the problems are mostly still ahead on this. This only promises to get much, much worse. I'm afraid the birth pangs of famine, yeah, we're going to see that sweeping the globe. And this latest development where the Western countries are putting more and more grain into alcohol has really caused a panic in poor countries where food prices have grown by 50%. They were already spending 85% of their income on food. And now you take food up to half again the value. What are they supposed to do? Starve. Pestilence is mentioned in several passages. In Revelations, it's the ashen horse comes riding in, plague and pestilence. And Jesus also mentioned it in the sermon, in the Olivet Discourse, not in Matthew, but if you look at the version in Luke, he mentions pestilence as one of these signs as well. Disease, in other words. That's surprising, because just when modern people thought, you know, we have conquered disease, that was the attitude people had in the 50s and 60s, you know, smallpox was gone. Measles is on the way out, and so on. And pretty soon we're going to sweep away, and you know, the power of modern science, we're going to sweep away disease. And we have made progress. I mean, it's not accidental or coincidental that the human lifespan has gone from 35 to 75 years in the West. That is a product of modern science. And yet, the Bible says that's not the way it's going to be. Actually, right when we think that we've conquered all these things, that horrific pestilence and plague will again sweep the globe. Now, this is an interesting one to ponder. I don't know whether we can say that this is happening, but keep your eye out. Do the reading on antibiotic-resistant bacteria and antibiotic-resistant parasites as well, which is a huge threat today. The scientific community, very worried about this. Quite a number of titles have come out on it. And it has the potential of causing widespread pestilence. Jesus also mentioned seismic activity like earthquakes. And again, it's easy, you know, to be sitting in front of the headlines and so on, like we have recently with massive quakes, and to jump to conclusions, and which I don't think we should. This is a very hard one to judge. You know, I've talked to geologists on this. What I've been shown is that the last 20 years has been a very active time compared to the previous four 20-year periods since we've been measuring with seismographs, late 1800s. But the problem is, in geological terms, that's the blink of an eye. That's nothing. So it really doesn't mean anything, even though we've had a large number of major quakes during that time. I think it'll be a lot more obvious if this one comes to pass. So we'll leave that one with a question mark there. There's also a geopolitical scenario laid forth in the Bible that needs to be in place before this great tribulation can happen. There's several distinct things that need to be there. First of all, as we went over 2 weeks ago, the regathering of the Jewish people into the nation of Israel. That was essential, and that was one of the least likely of these developments, and it's one of the most obvious that it is at hand and indeed has happened against all odds. After 2,000 years scattered around the world, they've come back, they've reformed their nation, retaken Jerusalem, just as Jesus said they would. And so one of the great signs needed is at hand. Also, last week we studied this concept of one worldism and how before this great tribulation can happen, there would have to be a higher level of integration in the world to where people could conceivably form some sort of international organization that would resemble a one world government. And I argued to you that the basis, the foundation for that has been laid. In our global economy today, nations around the world, and also through the information systems, the interrelatedness, the internet, the almost universal adoption of English as a way to communicate as a trade language, that the world stands at a level of integration today unlike anything in history. Nothing even remotely like this ever in history before. And this is a real hot area with major movement just in the past decade or two. Two decades ago, there was no internet. I mean, it existed, but no one even knew what it was. That's how fast the movement is here. So this is a shocking area, and I think this sign is at hand today and is building with incredible rapidity. Things can change fast in our world. You know, I grew up during the Cold War. When I grew up, it was the Soviets and the U.S., you know, boom, colliding heads. Who would have believed that within a four-year period, the Soviet Union would disappear? No one saw that coming. That was a shocker, man. That happened fast. Things can change pretty quick these days. In modernity, the change is more rapid under modern conditions. When you think of traditional, tribal, rural culture, things in a village, you know, have been the same for hundreds of years. Nothing ever really changes. It's very stable. But under conditions of modernity, the change starts to pick up speed like a runaway train, and it's exponential, the change. The Bible says that Europe is going to experience something similar to what Israel did, where there's going to be a reunification, an integration of Europe similar to what there was there under the ancient Roman Empire. This is foretold in Daniel. It's foretold in the book of Revelation. And so and I mentioned it briefly last week, the mortal head wound in the beast is the fact that the Roman Empire kind of disappears and then kind of reappears. And it's also very clear in the passages about it that it's not the geographical area of Rome, but the people and the culture of Rome. That's what makes up this power predicted to be there at the end times. It's specifically spoken of as a coalition of nations which come together, and then subsequently this is the group out of which the beast, the Antichrist, arises. Well, we look over today, you know, this that whole suggestion that what the French and the Germans are going to become one nation. The Italians, give me a break. And then we look over there, and lo and behold, that's exactly what they're saying that they're going to do. If you read the Treaty of Maastricht in 92, their intent is to become a United States of Europe. They use the same currency. All of this has happened during my lifetime. I went to Europe for the first time in the 60s, And even then, in the 70s and 80s, you would have to sit for an hour if you were going to cross a border, you know, and show, you know, and go through customs, and just like as if it was international travel. Here, now, there's just a sign and you just drive, right? It's like going from Ohio to Indiana. And where they're all using the same money. They have stalled out over having a European constitution. A brain fart. It's a constitution. They're trying to vote on a constitution. They can't get it passed. Different nations keep shooting it down. But it'll happen. It's been this way the whole time. Europe eases forward, then they step back, and then they ease forward further, and they step back. And it's been the development. I heard this predicted back in the 60s when no one had hardly even heard of the European Union, or they used to call it the European Common Market is what it was called then. No one even knew what it was. And people who were teaching the Bible declared, watch, Europe, one nation. Europe is going to reunify, a coalition. And decade by decade, that progress has been intermittent, but always forward to the point where we're standing today. This is almost, I'm going to give it a little stubby there, because it's like about three quarters there. They've got their own parliament now. They've got a president, and developments. The Bible says they're gonna do it. The Bible also has a great Eastern power referred to as the kings of the East. The only thing we know about this power is that they live in the East, east of the Middle East, and that they're very numerous. This is the one in Revelation 9 there. It's in connection with their entry into this last campaign of Armageddon that the number 200 million comes up for the number of fighters at this point. There's a huge influx, very numerous armed forces of this power. They are also the first one that is attributed to be guilty of slaughtering one-third of the human race. In other words, I would take it that that must be a nuclear power. So someone to the east of the Middle East, someone very numerous, and it sounds like they've got nukes. So there's actually a couple of countries that fit that description. China and India would both fit that description. For all we know, that power is already at hand. And then the final sociological point that's made is the coming of the beast. This is the guy who arises in the middle of this scenario and is able to get the allegiance of all the power blocks in the world for a brief period of time. It only lasts for 3.5 years, but there is world peace under one government. Well, we don't see the beast today. Although, when you think about it, he may already be alive and growing up. And, you know, you just can't really tell for sure. We'll just leave that. We'll leave that question open. Definitely technological signs, which we touched on last week. We saw that for the end times, there has to be a fiscal control system that spans the entire world, every people, nation, tribe, and tongue. And so that would require a vast network of computer controls like we do see today. We saw the entire world watching a single incident at the same time. It's very explicit on that point. Every tribe, nation, people, and tongue, and the entire incident is only a couple of 3 days long. And so they all watch it together. That sign is at hand. And of course, to be able to do that, you would also need satellites, and that sign is at hand today. So that whole picture is at hand. Tonight, we want to roll out one other, and that is the suggestion that nuclear weapons are also referred to in these predictive passages.
never by that name. But we saw in Matthew tonight, where he says this great tribulation, he says of it in 22 that unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. And the context of this always is war. So that it's not just like there's so many earthquakes that people are going to die or so many, you know, other things like that. It's war is the context for this last great tribulation. Let's look at a couple of Old Testament passages. Isaiah 24, the earth is polluted by its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated statutes. They broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. Now, if you go down to verse 21 through 3, you see that the context for this whole discussion are the last days. It's the judgment day of God, where he reasserts his authority. And this is happening right before that. God, in essence, according to Jesus, has to intervene to keep humanity from annihilating ourselves. He has to pull out his whistle and that's it. Okay, you had your chance. Now things are going to be back to the way they should be under my leadership. We read in verse 19, the earth is broken up. The earth is split asunder. The earth is thoroughly shaken. This shaking, this incredible, they refer to it like an earthquake, a shaking of the earth, comes through again and again in these passages. And it's like an earthquake like none that has ever happened before. A lot of people think that the prophets see kind of like a vision, like a visual vision, like a movie of events in the future. And then they go and try to write what they see. And it's you know, especially in several books, that's explicit that I saw this and so I wrote it down this way. Revelations is that way. So these could be ancient people. They've never seen an explosion before. Other than, they don't know gunpowder. They don't know what a gun is. They don't know what a bomb is. They've never seen anything like that. Yeah, they lobbed things of naphtha at each other. But how would an ancient man describe a movie of modern warfare if that's what they saw? You know, maybe they see everything shaking and things falling down, and they think they describe it as an earthquake. The earth reels like a drunkard. It sways like a hot in the wind. So heavy upon it is the guilt of its rebellion that it falls never to rise again. How about this one in chapter 13? A sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people, a sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering the army for battle. In many of these, you'll see God kind of taking credit, like I'm the one doing this, even though it's actually the people themselves. In biblical thinking, if God allows something to happen, that's the same as he could have stopped it. And so he'll say, for example, in Isaiah, I'm going to hire a razor from beyond the Euphrates to shave this land, and it's going to be the Assyrians. It's not that God made the Assyrians do it, but rather the Assyrians already wanted to do it, and he is not going to stop them. And so he's like, I'm letting it happen. But you see that it is battle that they're talking about. They're coming from a far country, from the furthest horizons, the Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. Therefore, all hands will fall limp and every man's heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. In most of these accounts, they talk about people being burned to death. And one of the things to remember is that in ancient warfare, people rarely died through burning. They died through getting clubbed, stabbed, slashed, or something like that, not fire. That's modern warfare where people get burned. He says, I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Ophir. Good Lord. It's very similar to what Jesus said. So if you were walking along and you found a gold nugget on the ground, that's about how likely it would be to find a living human being at this point, in that area at least. How about this one? It's really freaky. Zechariah, another Old Testament prophet. Again, to get the context, he's talking about the last days, and he says, I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle. And then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. And you can read, I'm skipping along here, but you can read all of these passages. You should write them down and go and study them yourself. In verse 12, he says, this is the plague with which the Lord will strike all the nations that fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. Okay, well, that's pretty morbid. But I guess when you die, always your flesh rots, right? I mean, that's, and where would your eyes rot if not in your sockets? So, I mean, in some ways, it's not that extraordinary, except for the key phrase right here. While they're standing on their feet. That is unknown. That is an unknown thing in the ancient world. We could guess what it might be. We've actually seen accounts very similar to this coming out of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's exactly what happens if you're anywhere near the epicenter of a nuclear blast. Just the flesh flayed off of the bones. This could well be. Let's go to the book of Revelation. Think a little bit more about some of this possible phenomenological language where a person is seeing something and trying to describe it in the words of his own day. The second angel sounded in his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. What's a mountain burning with fire? Volcano. Yeah, now they had seen volcanoes. And volcanoes kind of have like an explosion coming out of them, right? So that would be the closest thing they've probably ever seen to an explosion would be a volcano. But he doesn't say that it's a volcano, right? He says something like a mountain burning with fire. It's something that's like that. And what happens? A third of the sea is turned to blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died. A third of the ships were destroyed. It makes you wonder. Maybe what he's seeing here is a future attack of a naval battle, nuclear weapons potentially. A third of the sea dies. Here's another one in chapter 8. A third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is wormwood, a term they use for poison. A third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter. Okay. Some people are like, well, maybe it's an asteroid. Maybe it's a big meteor. It would have to be a poison one. It's possible. I don't think it's very likely. It's much more likely that what would poison the waters would be the radioactivity from a thermonuclear battle. Poison them enough to kill people, yes. And he says it's falling from heaven like it. Think about it. They've never seen anything fall from the sky before, other than perhaps a meteor. When you think of a blazing torch, and compare that to what a missile would look like. He could be describing a missile here. So this is like a blazing torch. I could see making that mistake. Verse 7 in that same chapter, the first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down on the earth. A third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned. All the green grass was burned. So he's seeing this, but you know, hail doesn't really burn the earth. A hailstorm would not burn the earth at all. And plus, it would be very localized. How could this happen of a third of the earth being burned? Is this what he really saw? And the objects coming down, and some of these, they describe objects falling from the sky. Okay, let's read another one. Here's one in Revelation 16. And they gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. This is definitely it, okay? There's no question about what's going on in this passage. This is the great last war of the world. Armageddon is a valley in northern Israel. And that's everybody is this war concentrates in the Middle East. That's what the Bible says is going to happen. It's a Middle Eastern war. There's war going on in other places as well, but the focus is in the Middle East. And now listen to this description. There came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. He says, no earthquake like it has ever occurred since man has been on earth. So tremendous was the quake. Every island fled away. The mountains could not be found. Oh, look at this. And from the sky, huge hailstones of about 100 pounds each fell upon men, and they cursed God on account of the plague of hail because the plague was so terrible. 100-pound hailstones. Okay, I've seen some pretty big hailstones. I had my van pulverized by fist-sized hail one time. That's pretty bad. The world record hailstone is like as big as a football. It weighs several pounds. 100 pounds? I don't think so. But again, if you're an ancient man, what have you ever seen come out of the sky? Hailstones coming down from the sky. But these are like not like those kind of. These are 100 pounds. These things are huge. And they come down and so forth. And then he describes this earthquake like nothing that's ever happened before. Again, this could well be describing. I think it's probably describing nuclear war. The same thing, and there's many more passages that talk about this. I'm just going to stop there because we got to finish. Nuclear weapons are definitely with us, and that's one of the things that we see. It's got to be nuclear if Jesus says all life on earth would end. What else could possibly do that? That's never been possible.
Everything remains the same as it ever was. Ever since the foundation of the earth, nothing's really changing.
I don't think this has ever been. I don't think any of those things have ever been there before. These are all just now, today, to there. They weren't there a generation ago. They've never been there before. Let's read a little bit more in Matthew. He says, so then if anyone tells you there he is, Jesus, man, there's Jesus out in the desert. Don't go out. Or, hey, we've got him in the inner rooms. Don't believe that either. He says, because just as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there's a carcass, there the vultures will gather. All right, that's a pretty cryptic statement there. But if you compare with Luke's version of this discussion in 17 of Luke, that statement is made in answer to them, one of them saying, where, Lord? They ask the question, where is this going to happen? And he makes this statement. So I guess he's just kind of like, wherever. Where the center of action is, people are going to gather there like vultures would over a carcass. Immediately, he says, after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light. Stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. This, again, may be perspectival language where he's saying from the surface of the earth, it's going to look like these things have darkened. Maybe because there's so much smoke and, you know, some people think most of this could be explained by a big asteroid. That could be. Maybe that's true. But where the earth is darkened, you can't see the sun, moon, or stars. At that time, the sun, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of earth will mourn. They'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his people from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. And so this could be describing the rescue of the people of God, and where he goes out and gathers his people, he says. And this could be referring to what theologians call the rapture, of believers, where he's basically going to snatch believers away so that they don't undergo this fate. Now he says this in 32. Learn the lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer's near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it's near, right at the door. The signs of the times, like the fig tree. Learn to recognize the coming of spring. And then he says, I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Some readers are saying, oh, see, Jesus blew it. He thought this was going to happen in his own day. I don't read it. When I read this generation, what generation? In context, the generation who sees all these things. So if you see all these things, in other words, when these signs start happening, it's not going to be another 500 years. It's saying that within that generation, they're going to know we're the ones. I think that's talking about us. I personally believe that. I may not make it, but I'll bet you guys will. I used to believe I will. It's not so sure anymore. I'm fading. I think that could be us. Heaven and earth, he says, will pass away, but my words will never pass away. And Jesus put his words right on the same level with the rest of Scripture when he says that. It says, no one knows the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, only the Father. So anyone that tries to start giving you, setting up dates and scenarios and saying it's going to be this date because of this numerological factor, just ignore that. Okay, nobody knows the answer to that. But we do know the general time, right? Because that's what that parable of the fig tree was. That when you see these signs, you know that spring's coming. And so he is saying the general time. Well, no, not the day or the hour, though. He says, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. There's a real sober part to that story about Noah, that he spent all these years building this ship out in the middle of nowhere. Nobody believed it. They all thought he was a fool. And there was a big gangplank that went into it. It was three story tall. This gangplank went up there. There was no rigging to close it. It was like, but that's how they loaded the thing. And it says, when he entered the ark, God closed the door. It wasn't Noah. God didn't leave that choice up to him. Once that door was closed, it was impossible to get into that ark. And so, you know, one moment it was open, next moment, closed, over. That's the way it's going to be, he says, at the coming of the Son of Man. A lot of the people were just very engaged in eating and drinking, marrying and giving. There's nothing wrong with that. He's not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's just the people were so preoccupied, just fussing over the little things of life. They never stopped to think about what's happening. Where is history moving? And so they're kind of oblivious as a result. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill. One taken, the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you don't know what day your Lord will come. This is probably not referring to the rapture. It's probably in the context of a Noah thing. This is the one taken is the one blown away. And the one that's left are the people that get to go into the kingdom that Jesus sets up on earth. Anyway, he says, understand this. If the owner of the house had known what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have had his house broken into. So you need to be ready, because the Son of Man's going to come in an hour when you don't expect it. And this is really the moral of this entire discussion, is you need to be ready for the coming of the Son of Man. I want to briefly read a passage in 1 Thessalonians that's on the same subject, being ready. This is in chapter 5. He says, now as to times and epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written for you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. It sounds like he's been reading Matthew 24, doesn't it? While they're saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly like labor pains upon a woman with child, and they will not escape. But notice this part. He says, but you, brethren, are not in darkness, that the day should overtake you like a thief. For you are all sons of light and sons of day. We're not of the darkness, nor of the night. Of course, God's given us signs that we can know, we can see this coming well in advance. And so we should be able to sense that, the parable of the fig tree. He says, so then, do not let us sleep like others do. Let us be alert and sober. That's one of the, there's one of the applications we should be taking away from this. If you're a believer here tonight, follower of Christ, this is not a time for apathetic slumber. The last days are an astonishing time to be alive, and events are moving quickly, and you want to be alert, sharp, aware. He says, those who sleep do their sleeping at night. Those who get drunk at night. So drunkenness, sleeping, they're both suggestive of people zoning out. You know, you're stoned. You don't know what's going on. We're not to be that way, he says. But since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and of love, and as a helmet, the anticipation of our rescue. I switched the word hope for anticipation, because that's really what it is. That's what it means. For God has not destined us for wrath, but for the obtaining of rescue through our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, well, well. Well, we know that, right? We're not under the wrath of God. And in fact, he's going to rescue people from his wrath. Christ, he says, who died for us so that whether we're awake or asleep, a euphemism meaning dead, physically dead, we will live together with him. And so we have this terrifically bold claim here that Jesus' death makes it possible for us to live no matter what happens. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone that comes to me will live even if he dies. And he says, anyone who believes in me will never die, will live forever, eternal life. Ultimate safety comes from a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. The death of Christ, it was not just a tragic event. It was a purposeful coming to pay the price for human sin, to make it so that we could get together with God again. And we have to wonder, you know, what if this is true, that we can make contact with God, get into a relationship with him through the death of Christ? Well, that would be the most important thing ever. And backing it up, one reason for believing that this claim is true is this immense volume of fulfilled, accurate, predictive prophecy describing in detail the world in which we live, a world so different from any that has ever existed before, and yet there it is right there on the pages. And I regret the fact that I have to whip through these passages so fast, but if you've taken a class, talk to the guys here that took our class on this, there's so many hundreds of passages that you have to read to really see. You know, when I was first taught this, I was really skeptical. I was a student. And I was listening to a couple of guys teach on the subject of predictive prophecy. And I'd just sit there and just be like, oh, I don't know, man. That sounds like they're making things come out the way they want. But I never had the time to study it. I was busy. And finally, after I graduated from college, I got to do some graduate study. And one other thing, I reached my goal and got to spend like a six-month period going through every one of these passages. There's hundreds of them. And I can tell you, it's there. This whole picture is really there. And the best way to be sure of that is to study it, which I would urge. Anyway, we're just going to have to settle for that tonight. The basic picture is clear. This one-of-a-kind predictive scenario that covers the whole scope of history, and including our own day. And that, I think, is a pretty compelling reason to think that when we pick up our Bible, we're picking up, this is not a normal book. This is the Word of God. He's the only one that could pull that off.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.